Hi, everybody. My name is Michael Millerman, and this is a course on the philosophical analysis of masculinity or manliness. Each of us has a rough sense already of what manliness is and isn't, whether we can express that adequately or not. But many of us also understand that we're living through a period of social and political history when manliness has been on the receiving end of an attack, launched in the name of the gender-neutral society, as Harvey Mansfield explains in the first chapter of his book called Manliness, but also launched in the name of the assertion that transgenderism and gender fluidity and other such categories are superior to gender essentialism. In this situation, we're compelled to try to understand better what it means to be a man and why the meaning of being a man has changed over time. We're going to begin our study by turning toward a seemingly simple question. Who is a real man? After all, just belonging to the male sex of your species does not guarantee that you are what someone would call a man in the meaningful sense. Otherwise, nobody could ever tell another man to man up or to be a man. When we're talking about manliness, we're primarily interested in the standard of man, in the real man. So we ask the question, who is a real man? There's no harm in starting from some common opinions. Here's an entry from Urban Dictionary, where a real man is defined as old-fashioned and chivalrous, as a provider, as someone who fights for and defends the people he loves. The real man is a hard worker. He's strong and he's faithful. He knows what he wants and he's grateful for what he has. In many ways, this is a healthy, common sense picture of what it means to be a real man. The real man has then these positive characteristics. Characteristics that we probably can't help but see as praiseworthy and desirable. At least in the case of most of the characteristics, just ask yourselves whether someone who had the opposite traits could be called a real man. I mean, the narrow-minded, lazy, disrespectful, weak, dependent, coward. Of course not. Here are some images of the actor Clint Eastwood, who might come to mind as an example of a manly man, together with John Wayne and others. And in fact, you should ask yourselves, who comes to mind for you when you think of the manly man? Who is he? What does he do? What does he look like? How does he act? Well, we knew that it wasn't going to be so straightforward as to see in manliness or in the real man only positive and praiseworthy characteristics. If that was the case, we'd have less need of a course like this one. So here's another entry from Urban Dictionary, another attempt to define or characterize the real man. I'm not going to read it out loud for you, but if you take a close look, you'll see that suddenly the idea of being a real man is associated with some negative traits. It's treated as a social role constructed by the expectations of others, which themselves are treated as illegitimate or harmful expectations. Being a real man here is somehow all about power and control. Not in the sense that the truly powerful men are justifiably in control, that they can take control of a situation as strong and competent leaders, but rather in the sense that the ideal of manliness controls or even brainwashes people into believing that something bad is good, that strength and leadership in and of themselves are positive qualities. After all, maybe this view leads to war for the sake of war, fighting for the sake of fighting. Is that so implausible a view? When Jack Donovan tried to characterize being good at being a man in his book, The Way of Men, the best thing he could think to say was that it is a gang mentality that fights to survive, independently, as he put it, of abstract moral questions of universal right or wrong. Someone who thinks that peace is better than war, or that abstract moral questions are not less important than fighting to survive, independently of the what for of the fight, could have some grounds for doubting whether the manliness of the real man is cause for celebration and nothing more. In other words, if you think that manliness really is just a matter of a gang mentality that fights to survive, then there may be good reasons for wondering whether manliness really should be an ideal that we strive to attain and that we support and champion. From this more skeptical perspective, a quote-unquote real man is based on a false ideal that leads men to compete, fight, and lord it over each other and everyone else, while depriving the individual of choosing his own self-identity. This position says that there's no such thing as a real man. Instead, beliefs about manliness lead to toxic masculinity. And what we earlier called old-fashioned in a good way is now interpreted as outdated, as a relic of a less progressive, less enlightened age. In this sense, if chivalry is dead, then it's a good thing that it is. We should move on. You might think that not everything old is bad, but not everything old is good either. Maybe the old-fashioned idea of the chivalrous man belongs to an era from the past that is better left behind as we move toward a gender-neutral society or some other kind of society that recognizes the infinite dignity not just of all men, but of all individuals, whether they are men or women or anything else, and independently of their ability to fight to the death for a cause, or to lift some number of hundreds of pounds in a show of manly strength. This image is meant to convey the impression that for some people, manliness understood not only as strength, but as all the other positive characteristics we saw earlier, is just impossible for actual males to step into, since it has no allowance for human weakness or frailty, for the fallen man, or the inwardness of psychological depth with all its nuances, as opposed to the sun and steel of ideal masculinity. What our brief look at two common opinions about the meaning of being a real man shows is that there's a conflict of interpretations over what it means to be a man. We're going to make this conflict of interpretations our theme, but from a specific perspective. We want to look at how philosophers help us to understand the conflicting interpretations over the meaning of being a man. As you'll see later in the course, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, shown here, is someone who's going to help us access both the contemporary criticisms of manliness and some ways to reassert manliness. But we'll have to work our way up to Nietzsche first, and he's not going to have the final word. I would now like to tell you the plan of the course and explain to you in what sense the course is a philosophical analysis of manliness. What I propose we do is not the only way you could apply philosophy to our question of what it means to be a man, but this way is still going to be helpful. What we're going to do is take the history of political philosophy as our guide and to ask how, in the case of major transformations in the history of political philosophy, there has been a major transformation associated with it in the understanding of what it means to be a man. I'll say more to justify this approach to the question as we move through the course. And by the end of the course, we can review what this approach brought to light, as well as what it left in the dark. Now, let me tell you straight away, there's more to being a man than we can learn from this kind of history. Perhaps most importantly, a philosophical analysis of manliness will leave unsaid some of what a religious analysis of manliness might bring to light. For in religion, more so than in philosophy, we're faced with an interpretation of man that makes central his role as a husband, father, brother, and son. And surely, in order to understand the conflict over the interpretation of man, we would have to think about those roles and their relationship to the religious traditions, where God is father, and where there is also, in some cases, the Son of God, together with the brotherhood of man and the faith of our fathers. All of that, which I can only mention to you now, is something that we're leaving to the side as falling outside the philosophical tradition to a certain extent, or outside the history of political philosophy that we're going to be looking at. By the way, I don't think there could be a comprehensive analysis of manliness that leaves nothing unsaid. Because the manly thing to do in that case would be to protest against the presumption of having captured in words what it means to be a man. The real man, I presume, does not want to be tamed or caged, and we also don't want a presentation that tames or cages the idea of the real man. Don't worry, that's not my goal. I just want to give you something to think about. So here's our task. We will look at three periods or moments in the history of political philosophy: the classical, ancient, or pre-modern, on one hand, the modern, and the postmodern. How is the standard of man understood in each of these cases? Why does the standard change when it does change? And what does this history teach us about where we've been, where we are, and where we might go next in the battle over the manliness of man? That's what we must think about and pay attention to in the coming lectures. We will take our first step by thinking about a basic question that you can discuss together or simply consider on your own. What, in your opinion, is the defining characteristic of a real man? At the start of next session, we will turn to our first reading of classical thought with an eye to one of the main answers traditionally given in response to this question.